you're a little bit removed from the actual touching and feeling and smelling, but you're out there doing it. But then you can be on your computer when you're not in the winery and checking temperatures on tanks and checking numbers and fermentation. So that part has made it, well, it's made it a little bit more freeing in a sense. So you can spend time in the vineyard, but still look at what's happening in the winery.
Welcome to the Abwasi Wine Buzz podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Clinton Lee. It's not often that one has the opportunity to meet winemakers that have been making wine for not one, but over two decades. Their products, their heart, their culture, their emotion is all within those bottles of wine, countless bottles that they've made. Today's guest is one of those exceptional people, matchless in their perfection and unsurpassed in their compassion and determination for the craft of winemaking. My guest today is Susan Luca, also known and highly respected within the industry. Welcome to the show, Susan.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Susan,
I love the introduction. I hope I can live up to it.
I'm sure you will surpass it with brilliance, Susan. Susan, you're an extremely talented individual whose life has traversed many fields, industries. You've been described as the perfect combination of science, art, people, and nature. Could you share with our audience, who is Susan Luca?
Oh my gosh. It depends. I feel like I'm such a chameleon that it depends on where I am and what I'm doing. And I find that I like most things, which makes it difficult when selecting a career because you're attracted to so many different things. But when I started studying wine, that's when it all clicked. Like, I love being around the people, the growers, your coworkers, the people that have come before you, the people that are coming after you, being out in the vineyard in nature, being so in tune with the weather. Like today, hopefully you can't hear it, but we're having a very windy day. So right outside my window, it's like very almost, it's stormy but sunny. It's a very interesting day today. So I think it just, I feel like I'm very in tune with all the different aspects. And to me, winemaking balanced all my interests. I was very lucky to find it.
So you might be described as a polymath, someone who's exceptionally skilled, talented in many, many areas. But what was it that specifically drove you towards, winemaking? Was it a romance? Was it a particular bottle or a visit to an area?
It was a visit to the Napa Valley, like that sealed the deal. I was at one of the wineries having a bottle of wine with a friend as the sun was setting. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is magical. Like, I want to be a part of this. And somehow it happened. I mean, lots of effort, but that doesn't feel like it was that long ago, although it was probably 35 years ago.
Well, I think what you're drinking must give you the elixir of life, because you certainly look extremely youthful, Susan. So congratulations on that.
Now, you'll get meditation.
Now, you've been making wine for over the last 25 years. Were there many women winemakers at that time?
In the beginning, no. The wineries that I worked at, I was the only woman for the first 8 years, I would say. And it was fine. I didn't even, you don't notice what you don't know what you don't know, right? And there had been some strong women at the wineries before I was there. So it wasn't like the cellar wasn't used to it. So there's always somebody kind of leading the way for you. And it's like now I feel like I'm surrounded by women and it's awesome. But in the beginning, it was a little, there were not so many. I can remember Marianne Graff had a consulting business. Mm-hmm. And my boss at the time, who was a man, said, you should go talk to her. So I had a problem a lot and she helped me with it. And it was just the start of like this something really interesting. And it was interesting and intuitive on his part to know that I would learn more from her potentially, or learn something different from her than I would from him.
That sort of camaraderie that, you know, a woman find perhaps more openly warming towards one another, you know, whereas there's often that saying that men have this sort of, well, this is my territory, your territory, let's see, you know, who will have dominance, you know, whereas there's more of an embracing culture with women winemakers, perhaps. Would you agree to that?
Well, and also I think maybe he wanted me to see that there could be a woman in that role. Like there's a woman that's in charge of the business and knew what she was doing. So I think he wanted me to find a role model.
Of course.
Potentially. It was, thinking back, like I would have never thought he had that instinct or intuition about what I would need. But I think he was just trying to be very, giving me more options and letting me see what was out there.
Were there any specific challenges that you faced right in those early days, not only as a winemaker, but also being one of the rare woman winemakers?
Oh, you know, people always thought I was like the daughter of the owner. When I would go to the hardware store to get something, they'd say, does dear daddy own the winery?
Oh, really?
And I would laugh and I would be like, I don't think I'd be wearing my cellar clothes if my daddy owned the winery. But, and I always looked very young. I would be assumed to be about 10 years younger than I really was. So they didn't realize that I was actually old enough to work in the winery. So, I don't think there were really any challenges that were insurmountable, like just hard work, set a good example. I never really felt like I didn't belong. And that's probably, you know, because of the people that I was working with and working for. And then I think I probably set the tone too, like there's nothing I can't do. I might take a little longer. I might take 3 trips to get that job done, but I'm going to get it done safely and I'm going to do it well. So I think you just power through. Right?
Well, I think that's a testament to your determination and fortitude, Susan. Now, you mentioned that there was a lady, Mary, correct? Is that right?
Marianne Graff, yes.
So Marianne Graff, what perhaps could best be described as the early mentor for you?
Yes.
Now, have you seen yourself in, you know, the years after having gained the experience yourself, have you been in that position for other women winemakers now?
Somewhat. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm very down to earth. And it's funny, I actually ended up working in the position that Marianne used to work in, not when we met, but the job that she had before. So it was an interesting turn of events. And yeah, I think, well, I'd always say I hired the best person for the job, but oftentimes that turned out to be a woman. So, and then the position that I had, that Marianne had, I think one of my proteges is in right now. So yes. And I think you just, you know, it's the same thing. You set the tone.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there must be a warm, glowing feeling inside when you see your protégés excelling in the craft.
Yes.
Congratulations.
We're going to celebrate.
Wonderful.
We're going to celebrate with bubbles soon.
Now, How has winemaking developed since the early days of your career? You know, you started Hacienda Winery up to the present day. What are some of the major differences that you've seen and had to adapt, Susan?
Oh, well, back in the 90s, it was, I felt like there was more physical labor, like actually touching, and it, you know, it depends on the size of the winery that you're in. Because we would pick in small boxes and dump directly into the press. So where I am now, it's much more automated, still with quality and gentleness in mind, but a lot more safety as well. I think that's probably the biggest evolution has been safety. I can remember one of my former bosses saying, in the beginning, we didn't really know what we were doing. But I never felt like that. Right. You might have been talking about in the 80s that they didn't know what they were doing. But I feel like in the 90s, we were kind of coming into our own as far as having a lot of experimentation and seeing what did work. Mm-hmm. I think one of the biggest things was having temperature control on the tanks was huge.
Right. Right.
And that doesn't sound very glamorous. But
no,
being able to control
it's absolutely vital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and you know, we are a little bit more automated, or we're trying to be a little bit more automated, where we can do things from the computer versus having to be at the tank in the cellar. So for a winemaker, you can have a lot more, you're a little bit removed from the actual touching and feeling and smelling, but you're out there doing it. But then you can be on your computer when you're not in the winery and checking temperatures on tanks and checking numbers and fermentation. So that part has made it, well, it's made it a little bit more freeing in a sense. Mm-hmm. So you can spend time in the vineyard, but still look at what's happening in the winery.
How far has the automation gone? Because there are some wineries that, you know, I've visited where they have, humidity sensors in the soil. They have fleets of drones that use infrared to check the ripeness of the grape. They have these optical liner meters where they're able to identify each precise grape. Have you gone to that extent? Do you see yourself, if you're not there already? Or is it something you even want to get to?
I think that's the next generation. It's going to be, for me, I still believe in my touch and taste and smell. So for me, like, it's a good tool to have if you're trying to figure out if a vineyard is going to reach a certain quality level. Mm-hmm. But for me, I'd rather be out there in the vineyard. I'm a little more hands-on. It's great information. It can give you a sense of maybe you're doing something wrong in that vineyard that you need to change to get a higher potential. So we've worked with it. We kind of go get close to it and pull back. And I'm old school. I like to look at the numbers, but I really want to taste and make decisions. You know, I want to look at it from every direction and not just from more of an automated, because I don't know exactly where their data is coming from. And I know part of one of those that we worked with, the information was coming from France. And I don't know if necessarily our climate and their climate interact the same, or it could be information from Australia. So it's going to be not all local information that's feeding into their automated system. So that's something you need to be aware of. But I'm
absolutely,
I like it.
Many different,
I'm wary
factors,
of it.
Yeah, yeah, because there's quite a prevalence where, you know, some of the winemakers were talking about fermentation earlier on, and you know, the temperature of the tanks, where they have the sensors and they're able just to check on their phones. You know, so that does give the winemaker that flexibility.
Well, then you can maybe during harvest go to a party or go to do something. Otherwise, you feel like you're pretty tied to the winery. And I go during harvest, I go to the winery every day. But it's also good for you to like take a break and maybe go to the coast, or, you know, you have to refresh a little.
That's very true. I recall my days of harvest as well, where you are literally 24/7 sometimes at the winery, and, you know, you have an area where you can rest. So, yes.
You feel guilty?
Yes. You do. Oh, what's happening to my babies, you know?
Yeah. But I always feel like I'd rather go in every day, because I feel like that day that you go away from the winery, like, the wine may have changed tanks, or like it takes you so much time to catch up that it's more time catching up than it is coming in for that day to just keep in touch and keep in tune with what's going on.
Of course, of course. Now, Susan, organic wine or grapes? A contest of wills for those in charge of definitions. What are your thoughts on the increased interest on organic wines? Is there such a creature that can genuinely be called organic wine, or is it best described as organic grapes that are used?
That's it's interesting, because where we are in Sonoma County, we tend to be more sustainably grown. So it's almost like the club that you're in. Like if you're, and I feel like Mendocino, the county to the north of us, they are much more into organic. Mm-hmm. So it's their culture where they believe organic is better. Whereas for me, sustainability is better. So being able to get a crop every year is more important to me than potentially losing a crop, because you can't go in and take care of a problem. So that, like, if you had to spray something that would save your crop for that year, I'd rather spray it once and not be organic than to be caught with no grapes. So it's, I think it's more of a philosophy. And then again, in the winery, it's very hard to find a good organic wine that's made organically because of the things that you can't add. Although I think we're getting better and better at lowering our SO2 usage in winemaking. And I think that's the primary issue. So things just are not as microbially stable or clean in an organic wine, winemaking. So I would, if it's completely organic, I'm always a little wary. You're hopeful, but wary.
I just think
things have to be too perfect.
You're absolutely right. My own thoughts are, you know, when you open a bottle of wine, if it's organic, you don't have a very long time before you can identify significant changes. And if you don't finish the bottle, certainly by the next day, it's very different. I'm sure you've had that similar experience.
And yes, and then of course there's the biodynamic too.
Yes, there's the biodynamic. That's very true.
It's kind of a continuum, right? So sustainable, organic, biodynamic, and you just kind of pick where you want to be on that.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, take an analogy of cars. You know, we're all in the car industry. One is electric, and then one is the sports car, and then, you know, the other one is the is the steady, you know, sturdy family car that's always there, reliable. It's very interesting. And I guess we'll just have to wait to see how the industry will change over the years with the new players. Now, Susan, with a name like Luca, where does that surname come from?
Oh, it's German. German. Some people have said it's German Swiss, but it's German.
All right.
Yeah. From my father.
All right. So talking about German. German.
I'm German Swiss on my mother's side, so I'm kind of German.
Okay. So with that pedigree, have you had the opportunity to have experienced a harvest other than in the United States?
I haven't. I was going to do a harvest in Australia. years and years and years ago, and I decided to stay in Sonoma County. So all of my winemaking experience has been in Sonoma County. I have some vineyards in Mendocino. I dabble a little bit in Napa, but for the most part, my wineries have been in Sonoma County.
Right. But have you yourself, I mean, I'm sure during your travels, you know, you've gone down to the sort of southern hemisphere. So you've seen harvests there.
Yeah.
What was the most contrasting or similarities that you found? I mean, with your experienced and seasoned eyes.
Oh my gosh, I think they go so fast and work so hard. And maybe because it's a more compacted harvest, because in New Zealand, it's primarily Sauv Blanc.
Yep.
So, and then again, in the Southern Hemisphere, they are more automated as far as picking and within the winery, because they just don't have the labor, because they're more isolated, especially in Australia. So a lot of what we've learned from mechanical harvesting, we've learned from the Southern Hemisphere. So, and I haven't done a harvest in France, but I've been to France.
Oh, I'm sure.
Uh-huh. For tasting wine and looking at cooperages. Of course, eating and drinking.
Susan would be impolite if we didn't do that in France. So, you know, you mentioned France. Now, the name Bordeaux conjures images of power, wealth, history, and the emotional tears of delight or despair at the sights of, you know, a truly fine wine. So, but it comes with a price though, Bordeaux wines. Can you share with us the Bordeaux program that you are leading at the Kendall Jackson Wine Group?
Oh, well, my Bordeaux program, that works mine.
yes, under your tutelage.
is Bordeaux varietally based. So it's grown in Sonoma County and our estate vineyards primarily. We have some of the most beautiful vineyards. We have Kellogg in Knights Valley, which is about 600 to 1,000 feet in elevation. So most of our vineyards are high elevation. The Jackson family's credo is to build on hillside and ridges. So they are stunning. And they also all have stunning views. Like, I'm always, it's awe-inspiring when I'm out in the vineyard. Like, you have to just take a deep breath and look around and take it all in and then focus on what you're there for. But they're all so beautiful. So I'm very lucky that I get to do blends that range in size from about 150,000 cases, quite large, to 250 cases. So all cab based, except for I have two Merlot programs that I work with. And that one is a vineyard in Bennett Valley. It's Jackson Hills. And it is, Jess Jackson was reminded of Saint-Emilion when he was looking at this piece of property. And so it's planted primarily to Merlot and Cab Franc. And it's just lovely. I was just out there on Friday in the morning and it's looking beautiful.
Mesmerizing, is it?
Yeah. I know. It's funny because I feel like my first job here is to fall in love with the vineyard so I can get the best from them.
Absolutely. I mean, the fact that, you know, you're saying it's on high elevation, you know, and by the Sonoma, you're still getting that crisp breeze coming in from the coast. You must have good acidity, you know, if it's on a higher elevation and your diurnal ranges must give you a little bit more latitude in what you can make.
Well, and I think there is that nod to Bordeaux too, because of that. We do have more structured wines, higher acidity. The tannins are really interesting too, because each location gives you a very different tannin profile, whereas Knights Valley tends to be a lot more linear and softer. And it's based on the soil. I think it holds a little bit more water, maybe has a little longer hang time than the higher elevations are. They have some big tannins, big color, big tannins, tiny berries.
Thunderous. you know, Susan, climate change has affected virtually every single winery, you know, on this planet. And Bordeaux is no exception. They recently, about 6-7 months ago, introduced other varietals that they allow on the left bank. And one of them was the Touriga Nacional, which is more famous in the Portugal Douro region. Mm-hmm. Do you see that perhaps surfacing in any of your vineyards?
Yes. I mean, we have not planted in our vineyards, our estate vineyards, we haven't planted. And we would probably go slowly with that and look at the other vineyards around us and taste what other growers are doing with it. We're also thinking potentially Tempranillo. We've been looking at our friends down in Baja California to see what they're growing and how that's working for them. So they have interesting blends too, because of course they are like, they're not lawless. They don't have the same for us. Like, it's like, oh, Bordeaux varietals. We don't want to put any Zinfandel in that, or we don't want to put Zinfandel and Petit Verdot was a blend that I tasted not long ago. And I'm like, this is pretty interesting. So maybe it's going to be introducing more blenders or Italian varieties or Spanish varieties. And I think that's going to be our next challenge.
Well, technically, if you're doing that Bordeaux grapes, you could add your Tempranillo and Touriga Nacional because it is allowed on the left bank now. So I found that quite intriguing. Now,
it's super interesting that the French are open to that. So it means,
yes,
because you know that's not easy. That change is not easy. So it means there's something really there that they're seeing it, or actually maybe they're opening up a little bit more too.
That's also a possibility, and it's a trend. You know, talking about trends, trends reflect situations. It said, where do you see the trend of wine styles in the next 10 years, given the changing demographics and the makeup of the US population, Susan?
You know, we talk about that a lot, because especially with some of the younger winemakers, and it's interesting to me that they want to make a lighter style, lower in alcohol, just fresher, lighter, easy drinking. I would almost think it would be the opposite, right? For young winemakers, usually they want to go big and you kind of have to reel them in and tame them down a little bit. So it's interesting to me. And we're like, I didn't do it, but one of my colleagues was doing a pet nat. So for this last vintage in 21, and it turned out really well. Like, you know, we're just doing small lots, and then he also did a Piquette. So I think it's just looking at what's more casual, potentially casual. It's very rustic, but it's appealing to a younger audience. So I think Kendall Jackson in itself is going to stay true to our nature and its course, but we're lucky because in Jackson Family, we have different brands. So we can have a brand that's more appealing to a younger person. And then we have our, and we believe in our style too, saying, you know, if your grandfather liked it and your father liked it, you're going to like it too. Eventually, like, you'll get there. So I think we're very steady, stay the course, but we also realize that there are people that are going to want to have something different. So we have those little experiments that are going on in the background and seeing how they taste. And if I think it's interesting, and I'm willing to buy that and try it, I'm sure other people will as well.
You know, there's this trend to have wines in cans now. What are your thoughts on that?
we did a lot of research with that, And we found, we did a little bit. We still do a little bit. But I can tell you it's pretty, it can be pretty awful. Like depending, I've been on an airplane and that's all the wine that they had was in can. And when I popped it, I'm like, oh no, thank you.
I mean, yeah. It certainly will have an effect. And
Yeah. And it's, you know, that I think they will figure out the liner to use and the combination and how long wine can stay in can.
Mm-hmm.
And it's obviously environmentally friendly because it weighs less than glass. It doesn't have the same appeal, I don't think. But it's an option right now. I don't know how viable it is at the moment.
Well, there are some sectors that find it more appealing. And like you said, others that it's just a passing fad. Now, talking about change, what advice, Susan, would you share for any of our audience that's listening who are aspiring winemakers and they are considering to get into this industry? What advice would you share with them?
Oh, I think read as much as you can, drink as much as you can, or taste as much as you can. Like, see, broaden your experience. You can work in a winery for harvest. You can be an intern if your lifestyle affords it, if you can not work or you can, like, I think we're really lucky now, you can take classes online. So you can further your education in so many different ways. And if it's resonating with you, I think you make a commitment to it. And, you know, I mean, you never know until you actually do it. But if you can take a small sabbatical and do a harvest or go to the tasting room and talk somebody into it, into letting you talk to the winemaker and see if you can work with them, there are places where that happens. And sometimes, like, don't overthink it. Just do it. Just step out there and do it. Because if you overthink it, you're going to talk yourself out of it.
Yes. Now, we've all had experiences, Susan. What was your most stressful winemaking experience in all your years?
I think
stuck fermentation.
You know, I kind of like a stuck. I always say they're listening, but nobody's stuck right now. They're all finished from 2021. So,
right.
I don't mind a stuck fermentation because it's a challenge, you know, and it's like trying to figure out what caused it. And we don't have as many as we used to. We're getting smarter. I'm just jinxing myself right now. I think the hardest thing right now, the biggest stressor, is lack of water for us.
Yes.
And for me, because that's always been a tool you can have to moderate your ripening or try to slow something down or actually speed it up or, you know, make a more healthy vine and a better grape supply is with water. It's like, so not having that or having very little last year was difficult. COVID was definitely a challenge. How do you make wine when you can't get close to anybody? That was huge. And of course, like the fires in 20. So I think 2020 was I don't know how we're going to do it. I know we can do it if we had just COVID, but we have COVID and we have wildfires and
lack of water.
So I think that was just like the most stressful vintage and we did it. So, I mean, and I think that's always good. Like when you have those challenges and you actually get through harvest and you make wines that work. And so, you know, it makes you realize you can do it. It just, that one, 2020 was the one I was like, I'm not sure how we're going to do this.
Well, you know, I think you've been very modest, Susan, and I think it would be more than challenging for many other winemakers that didn't have your length, breadth, and depth of experience to go through this trifecta of disasters. So applause and congratulations to you for going through that, you know, honestly.
It's probably a little bit like childbirth too, like once you're done, you're like, oh, that wasn't so bad. We can do that again.
But when you're right in the sort of center of it all, it's a totally different perception. So once again, congratulations.
Thank you.
Susan, what are your thoughts on, you know, 30 years ago, these countries were not even really considered to be on the map. Now, there are now new and upcoming wine regions like China and Israel, both in terms of acreage and quality. Your thoughts on them, on those countries?
Oh, you know, I don't have much experience with the wines coming from China. I know I had a colleague that went and was part of almost like a winemaking experiment, mm-hmm. where each winemaker was given a certain part of the vineyard. And I think this was more of a learning experience for the Chinese winemakers that they were working with, because they got to learn from each winemaker, like, oh, this is how I would handle this. And I thought that was really interesting, but I haven't tasted much wine coming out of China. I mean, years and years ago, I had a Chinese lab partner that we couldn't really communicate very well. And I know she was going to go back and she was going to like start the industry in China. And I haven't kept in touch with her. But in Israel, I know from the Golan Heights, I've had wines from there, and I've had friends that work there. And Zalma Long, another one of my giants that I'm standing on the shoulders of, like, she's been going to Israel for quite a while and working with them. But I haven't had the opportunity to taste that many wines from there either, but I know it's, and that, I mean, that to me seems more difficult than China for growing grapes, just because of the desert. Although I guess if you can control the water,
That's true. And there are certain areas where the grapes flourish. We've interviewed quite a number of Israeli winemakers, and it was startling, the news that they were coming with. But certainly their wines are certainly very robust and very big and structured in the Bordeaux style. As for the Chinese, they are committed to having an area four times the size of Bordeaux. That's what they want. And I've been to many, many wineries. They're very, very high tech, all of them. And that's the route that they've taken. So only time will tell. And I hope we have the chance and opportunity for you and I to try some of those wines together one time.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Now, I know we touched on climate change just a few moments ago. This water issue. What's being done in California? Because it is reaching a very serious level where the operational capacity of wineries and other businesses are now starting to be threatened.
Right. Well, we're trying to get smarter in the vineyard. And I think it's one of those things where we've had to react pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing people doing more mowing so that there's less competition with the cover crops and disking in. So there's more. So I think people are taking care of the soil a little better. I think we're looking at ways that we can use less water throughout the year, maybe putting water on earlier, and getting the vines healthy. And that's not too unusual. I mean, we couldn't do what we wanted in the vineyard because we almost had too much water some years. So the drought years would be the ones that were really, well, we thought we were having a drought, but we were still getting rain in the winter. So just being very, very smart with how you're using your water and everything that's happening in the vineyard. So because last year the quality was exceptional, and you know, so you are getting smaller berries and more concentrated fruit. It was just, for me, it was just difficult because I might want that to stay out a little longer. Typically I would put on a little bit of water so that it could, the vines would be healthy, everything would be fine. And I didn't have that option. And we were lucky because I think our harvest was smaller last year that we could. And it was crazy too, because we were picking Chardonnay and Cabernet at the same time. And
that
never happens. Like you kind of have your plan within the winery, like,
of course,
we'll use this area for Chardonnay. And when Chardonnay is finished, then Cabernet will start to come in, and then we'll use those tanks. And so we just tap danced a lot and made it happen. But I think we're getting smarter, and you know, maybe monitoring things a little more closely too, more probes in the soil, and making decisions on, does it really need to go in now? You know, do we really need to water now? I mean, and we used to. I can remember like frost. We're almost maybe out of frost season, but you didn't want to use your water for frost protection because you wanted to keep it
for later in the season. Yeah, of course.
But we did have some rain this morning, and it looks like we're going to have rain this week. So
wonderful.
I think that's the other thing. We're always ever hopeful that we do get what we need.
So Susan,
I always say plan for the worst and hope for the best.
Yes, very wise words, very wise words. Now, Susan, my last question to you. Your perfect food and wine pairing, no cost is spared. Any food and wine anywhere in the world. And I'm going to say you have to leave out Kendall Jackson, because we know they would be certainly on the menu and on the table. So literally the last meal, what would it be, from the appetizer right through to the dessert, with accompanying wines for you?
Well, my husband is a chef, so, and he's French trained, so.
That'd be French, right?
For me, I would say, I mean, my favorite, I've been eating clean for a week, which is not very long, but the thing I was craving was champagne and potato chips. It's not
champagne and potato chips. Okay.
High end.
All right.
But maybe we could put a little caviar and creme fraiche on the potato chip to make it a little more a little more luxurious. I love foie gras and a white port would be one of my favorite ways to start the meal. Probably have duck from Sonoma County, of course. From Petaluma, from the duck man. But I think we'd have to have a roan with that. And then I know I'm not very specific. And usually, like, I have two courses and I want to be done. A lovely fresh salad. Where could that be from? Not my garden.
Okay. Yeah.
How about the Kendall Jackson garden? I'll take the fresh salad from their garden and pair it with Sauvignon Blanc from Graves, and maybe that's it. But for dessert, probably a little French macaroon, assortment of French macaroon.
Very tasteful, very tasteful.
Light and delicious.
What a wonderful meal, Susan. What a wonderful meal. I certainly hope that during my next visit to your neck of the woods, I would hope that we have the opportunity to meet.
And
visit you. And that would be the highlight of the tour when I come down there. Susan, you've been a wonderful guest, and you've shared with us insights that I think are extremely valuable for those that would like to get into the world and into the industry of winemaking, and an inspiration for women winemakers. And I'm sure that any of the audience that are thinking of getting into the world of wine, perhaps my suggestion to them would be to look and share your career path. You've been exceptionally gracious, and we thank you very much for joining us on the Obuasi Wine Buzz. Thank you so much, Susan.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Wine Buzz Podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please leave a review or share it with a friend. Obuasi is an online wine and spirit institution dedicated to promoting culture and diversity through the world of education. If you're looking to get started, we have a free online course that we are giving out to all our listeners. For more information, head to obuasi.com. That's APWASI.com.